Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to FFS. I'm David Coulthard, and here, smiling or scowling on the screen in front of me, is Eddie Jordan. How are you, EJ?
I always come over you there, David. If you notice, I try not to let you finish because I don't need you to steal the glory of the intro. You know, you've got to give me a chance of being able to come close to you in this.
Listen, there's no fear of me stealing anything from you, I can assure you. Right. EJ, we have just had the Japanese Grand Prix.
Sorry, I need to tell you the listeners, because you nearly stole my virginity because you brought me to your bed, if you remember, when we were trying to do something in Baku all those years ago. And you claimed you woke up in the middle of the night and you had to touch my neck to see was I alive. I think we won't let the listeners forget that little one.
No, because you went to sleep with your arms sort of crossed over you like some sort of, you know, something you'd expect to see in a Dracula movie. And in the middle of the night when I woke up, you were still in exactly the same position. So, you know, I didn't want to wake up with a corpse. So I had to check you had a pulse, which thankfully you did. But
I think you've woken up with plenty of corpses in your life, DC. Come on.
Never. Right, look, we've just come off the back of the Japanese Grand Prix. But what I'd like to talk about in this episode, before we get into some points from our anchors, is the influence that Japan has had on both of us, specifically for yourself, EJ. If I look, even before Formula One, I know that you had a number of your Formula 3000 drivers. You realized that there was money to be made in Japan with their championship. So you had a number of the guys go out there under your management. So you were getting income from Japan prior to you then founding Jordan Grand Prix. And then, of course, you had Mugen Honda, I think you had Yamaha. Just give me the download on all the money you've taken out of Japan.
But the drivers that I had there, when I think about it, there was Ralf Schumacher, there was Kenny Acheson, there was Irvine, Martin Brundle. There was Martin Donnelly. More than half the grid were on some form of earn-out bonus for EJ. So, but the pain side of that, because nothing ever comes for free. And I remember doing, if you remember how many months there are in a year, and then think about it, I did 20 return flights in 1 year to Tokyo. And it was at a time where you had to go London, Anchorage, because no one believed they could fly over the North Pole at that time. And we were flying through Anchorage. It was a ball ache, I have to tell you, it was a shocker. And how I survived that, I don't know. I suppose the increase and the influence of a budget in my bank account probably helped alleviate certain amounts of pain. But I feel I've suffered as a result. But what it did do, it created an opportunity for me. You know, we talked about Fuji, where they were a sponsor of Jordan at the very first year in 1991. A lot of people shy away from Japan because they don't know enough about the culture and don't know enough about the country. I embraced it. And I remember Jean Alessi and I having the time of our life there. With the result, Jean married a Japanese girl. She was a very famous movie star. And, you know, I have the most incredibly nice memories of Japan, and I read all sorts of things about maybe a race coming into the center of Osaka and losing. We lost Fuji. Remember, we used to have a Grand Prix there, and of course, we're now in Suzuka. And for me, it's absolutely, there's some corners on that which are beyond any doubt the best corners in all of Formula One. David, you know about that.
Yeah, I think that Suzuka is one of the truly great challenges for a driver. Interestingly, designed by the very same man who designed Zandvoort but he had a vision for using the natural topography. Both Suzuka and Zandvoort use, you know, the rise of the landscape. It's a figure of eight there, and it really is a circuit. You take a breath at the beginning of the first sector, and with the time you come out of the second Degner and up to the hairpin, that's when you start to breathe. It really is a brilliant racetrack. So Japan has had a huge influence on Formula One. They once had their own entire Honda team, but I think we go back to, that was back in the John Surtees era. But more recently, of course, it's been about engine supply. When they had their all Honda team that didn't work out for them, that became Braun. And then that was the sort of lucky strike that year, wasn't it? Not lucky strike as in the cigarette brand. The Mercedes gave them an engine, strapped it in the back of a Honda and called it Braun, and they won the championship.
Well, let's get this kind of straight, because I wouldn't want to take away any credit from the great Aguri Suzuki, because he was the chosen one of Honda. If you remember, he was the one who won a couple of podiums in the home race in Japan. So he was like a god. He could walk around anywhere. He was an extremely personable person. He had time for everybody. And I don't know what happened, but the Japanese sort of let him run out of money or run out of interest, and then Braun took it over. But that design, let's be very clear, the design of that Braun car was as a result of what was created in the previous 6 months at Aguri Suzuki. And yes, Braun made it different, as we all know. We all stood in a team principals meeting and we all agreed not to have the double diffuser, except Ross Braun defied all that, and that's why I have a little bit of an issue with Ross, because he absolutely openly, in front of all the teams, he went against us. And I didn't think that was playing it fair, but that's something for the folklore now.
Yeah, I did notice, actually, when you mentioned about that, Ross. He on the Schumacher documentary on Netflix, which the opening trailer, he's there giving a very strong opinion about how to drive a Grand Prix car. And although I have tremendous respect for what he's achieved in his technical roles, I don't remember any of the races he's driven in, but he had a very strong and negative view as to why I was the root cause of...
Well, he wouldn't fit in anyway, because he's about three times the size of you nowadays, David. So
that's another story. That's another story. But anyway, look, I think we're going to move it along to some input from the anchors. So we've got one here from Marco Hopman. And he's asking who keeps the trophies that are won in Formula One. And he's seen the images of trophy cases at McLaren and Red Bull, and it includes the drivers' trophies. So in answer to that question, Marco, the original trophies all stayed with the team, and replicas were made for me as a driver. And I guess that's the same with most of the other teams. EJ, how did you do it at Jordan? Did you keep the trophies or did you let the drivers?
We didn't have a trophy cabinet. Didn't like them. When we went into the reception of Jordan Grand Prix, we always had the car that was currently racing, or a mock-up of that, or a show car. And other than that, there was very little else. And we found a way of either auctioning off or giving away to charities or whatever it is. But to answer your question directly, the driver got nothing. And if he wanted a replica, he paid for it. It's as simple as that. So the trophy was owned by the team. You're absolutely quite right. Except on one occasion, I remember winning the Grand Prix in Monza, and my longest ever serving member of staff was Andy Stevenson. I hope I don't get him into trouble by saying this, but Andy Stevenson was such a loyal and such a great supporter and worker, and part of the thing that everything that Jordan had, he epitomised. And he asked me very graciously, could he ever see me giving him the trophy? And I have no compulsion. I gave it to him. Of course I gave it to him, because he asked so nicely about it, and he felt attached to it because it was his car that won, and Monza is quite special. So I hope you enjoy it, Andy. It's a great trophy to win in Monza. Now that I reflect over races, there's not many better places to win Grand Prix than Monza, the atmosphere, the Tifosi, and beating McLaren that time, because we were actually quite popular with the Italians, because Ferrari weren't going to win the Grand Prix, and the last person they wanted to see win the Grand Prix was McLaren, so Jordan were the favourites, and that was a bonus, I have to say.
say.
Yeah.
No, that's a great story. And I think that's wonderful that Andy has that. He's still very active in a senior role running the Aston Martin Formula One team. This same gentleman, who Marco Hopman, who sent that question in, he also has a bone to pick with you, Eddie, because apparently he sent you his CV before he graduated as a mechanical engineer back in the mid-90s, and he never heard back from the team. I would assume you would have always had a policy that anyone who sent anything into the team got a response of one, or, you know,
absolutely,
in one way or another. So
I'm really surprised. So am I going to apologise?
I think you should.
I suspect, Marco, you're probably not the only one, but, you know, these things where they got delivered to the right place, I can't actually say it came to the right place. So I don't know. I'm going to deflect all the flack and say, are you sure you got the address right? But anyway, the reality is, and David, this is a question I'm going to throw back to you. At that time, we would get, on average, 100 or more letters per day with self-addressed envelopes with English stamps, everything attached to it, so beautifully put together, looking for autographs for me, or particularly the drivers, and photographs and stuff like that. It becomes a massive job, but we are so lucky to be in a sport where we have this kind of so-called adoration, or if you like, appeal. And I have never not responded or replied to anything. Now, I'm not saying I signed everything, because, David, you will admit this. When you get things for a team, you would spend half the day when you go to the circuit. Before you go out to the circuit, you'd sign a whole lot of autographs, and there would be somebody there to send them on for you. And of course that happens. But there are occasions where you're away for 2 or 3 weeks, and rather than have a massive build-up, you would get somebody to sign your name. And I'm sure that's happened with you. And I'm, on very, very small occasions, it has happened to me. But it's not something I'm particularly proud about. But, you know, you can't sign everything, and you can't be in many places at the same time. So sometimes, Marco, and I apologise if you did get the address right, and if it did come to me, because it's not in my style. And remember, I wouldn't have known whether you were worth $55 million and I could have tapped into you, or you were penniless. So, you know, of course I would have responded to you. But it's not a money thing. It's just the adoration, the fact that you were a Jordan fan was important to us. And therefore we wanted to reflect that importance by making sure you felt embraced within the team and got the right reply.
Yeah. Well, EJ, I've never had someone sign for me a signature or anything. Either got my signature or it didn't get any signature at all. So there's my position on it. I've got another one here from Georgia Chisholm, and she wants to ask a question. She's currently writing her dissertation at the University of Manchesteruni, whatever that is, and why it's taken around 6 years.
University, I think it is.
Well, let me finish the question then.
Manchester University.
Manchesteruni, you think so?
Well, on the basis that you never saw the inside of a university, I have to tell you, UNI is an abbreviation for
university. Ah, you know what? I've just worked
You're
it out.
You're such a dick, honestly.
I've just worked it out. There's no gap in the way they've written this. I thought this was an American university or something. Manchester Uni, it should be.
You are dense.
No. I think it's just a typing error on this script here. But anyway, she wants to know...
Let me finish
the question for fuck's sake.
You are such a dick.
She wants to know why it's taken 6 years for Formula One to be considered popular in the US. She wants to know why we think it is, because Liberty Media has focused everything to American audiences. I think there's obviously an element of them understanding America. They're an American-owned business, so they have got, let's say, a little bit time fortunate with Drive to Survive, because it was launched at the point when COVID was upon us, and therefore there was a more captive audience to tune in and watch it. I think it's as simple as that. I don't think that America has suddenly woken up to Formula One. It's just been presented to them in a way that it's you know, made them interested.
I grew up in the Bernie era, and I remember at a team principal saying to me, guys, we've got to go to America. And it was all talk about Miami doing a race in New York. But we settled with Tony George in Indianapolis. And Tony George was huge for American sport. And he was the one who opened the doors for us, in my opinion. If you've ever been to a place where there is 400,000 or 500,000 spectators watching a race. That's what happens at the Indianapolis for their race, the 500. And we had something like 300,000 or 400,000, which was the biggest single day ever sitting down on a circuit. It was massive. And I think it has slightly grown from there. I think there is other aspects. I think the Lauda Hunt movie was important. Senna, Schumacher. A number of the movies that were put together has all helped, because whether we like it or not, America likes to be entertained, either at home or at races or whatever it is. And I think we are so fortunate. Motor racing has just had the most amazing opportunity here, and full marks to Liberty. John Malone, obviously Irish blood, and he's the front man of this whole organisation, because it's not just Formula One, it's Ticketmaster, it's Live Nation with the rock and roll. So he has built a business into phenomenal proportions. And what he's doing with Formula One, I just hope, in my opinion, I just hope that he sees it through. By that I mean, I wouldn't want him to see it selling it off, because I think the value of this has gone through the roof. We see what the value of the teams is now, which is scary for me. I mean, you might say to me, DC, why didn't I stick it out for another few years? I could be a billionaire. But I've also said what MMTT is, more money than time. It makes no difference. You know, you don't want to die and be the richest man in the graveyard. So when you go in the box, David, you go in on your own, and you can't bring that money with you.
Yeah, no, I understand the statement, because it's referring to the fact that if you're dead, you're no longer able to spend your money. But actually, I think I would like to be the richest man in the graveyard, because it means prior to death, I was a wealthy man.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Previously, we've spoken about what it's like to be a team principal on a race weekend, but some of the anchors have reached out to try and understand what it's like to be a driver. And one of the talking points that we've got here is what was the favourite and least favourite parts of a race weekend? Well, for me, the Thursday. I really didn't enjoy Thursdays at Grand Prix, because it was essentially just media day. And it was all, you know, what do you think is going to happen? What can you do? It's all a crystal ball stuff. And I've never been very good at doing predictions. Where once you get into Friday, you've driven the car, you've got something to talk about. So I always felt that although it was important, and you at Jordan knew very well the importance of getting column inches, it was just a lot of waffle. You know, there's nothing tangible to talk about on a Thursday. But once we were into Friday, Saturday, Sunday, the whole weekend was built.
I thought Thursday was perhaps the most important day of the Grand Prix weekend, because I can remember, you know, that wonderful boating area in Montreal. We used to have boating races across the thing, and we'd have all the journalists in different cars and different colours, and we'd get them talking about things, and then we'd do a barbecue at the motorhome, and we would do things where the journalists would actually come to say, do you know, Jordan are making that bit of an effort, because we sure as hell we weren't going to do it in the race, so we were obviously getting the column inches on the Friday and possibly even hopefully the Saturday, and certainly some photojournalists, because that was important to get the picture and the car and the yellowness and the way we were. So I thought Thursday, I disagree with you, DC, from a team point of view, Thursday was vital. We also used to always have, because we hated coming together for team principals meetings, and Bernie would always convene them for Thursday afternoon and then maybe go and have dinner or something like that. And I disagree. Thursday was a great day for me.
Okay, well, the next point is how many sponsor media commitments do you have over a weekend, and do they interfere with your preparation? Well, I think it's something that evolves over time. At Williams, there didn't seem to be too many sponsor events, quite honestly. When I went to McLaren, it was quite different. And it seemed to me that every night we were involved in a dinner, which I like to be back in my hotel room and into bed early. And I just needed my sleep, and I like to wake up early and get some exercise before heading to the track. That was how I like to prepare. So I really, if I wasn't obliged to go to a team dinner, I had room service and went to bed. I didn't want to go out to a restaurant and then be distracted by everything that happens there. So I got to the point where I asked Ron Dennis, could I just come along and do the cocktail, you know, just meet everybody, you know, show the fact that I appreciate their support, and then leave them to go on with drinking wine and eating food until 10, 11 o'clock at night, because it just didn't work for me. And thankfully, Ron understood that. And that's why, actually, I ended up having a motorhome and staying at the track. I would just finish with the engineers, finish any of my obligations, go to the motorhome, have some dinner, chill, and go to sleep naturally. So that worked for me. What about yourself? I assume you would have to be out with partners all the time.
Absolutely. And I think when we had Damon Hill on, do you remember he was quite vocal in slagging me off? He said that the night before his first win for Jordan, our first win in Spa, I wanted him to go with the Deutsche Post, Postbank and DHL. We're having a popular evening. And like what you just said, we never ever requested the drivers to stay for the dinner. They would be at the top of the table. They would just stand up and say thank you to whoever it was, have a drink and a little bit of the cocktails beforehand, and then leave. So Damon didn't come to that. And he points out that he did the right thing. He stayed with the engineers to find out the last and the most critical detail of the changes that he needed to the chassis to do the very best thing. And that was on the Saturday night. And who's to say he's wrong because he won the race? Look, there's other things. David, I remember you. And some things like that never really, they don't leave my mind. I think you once said that having sex before a race makes you go faster. Now, I'm just trying to figure out what kind of room service was that?
It was obviously just a bit of BS.
Room service and sex before a race, are they sort of interlinked or not?
No, not at all. Look, it is, I think, headline grabbing statements. That was obviously one that I felt, I don't know who was doing that particular interview, but...
But did you say it?
Quite possibly, but not that I remember. So I could deny it because I don't remember, but it does sound like something I would say just for the reaction. Actually, did you ever have sex before a race?
But it didn't matter. I wasn't driving the car. I could do anything I want the night before the race. But I could tell you about a driver, and I'm not going to mention his name, but I could remember going to the motorhome, running like absolute mad back to the motorhome to drag a driver out of the motorhome who just was last seen with a girl, and he should have been on the grid. And I'm not telling you who it was, but he led the race. But anyway, move on. Yes, you're right.
Okay, so one of the other...
They were in the old days, David.
They were in the old days indeed, yes. One of the questions here is about any unusual methods of preparation and who got most nervous during the race days. I used to get a little bit nervous before the start of a race, but it was good nerves. It was that lovely feeling, that little tingle in your belly, which is kind of fear focusing the mind. And how I like to prepare for a race with just being very methodical in the time, you know, having a little bit of rest. You know, I'd like to be in my driver area maybe 45 minutes before the race. I've done everything I need to do in terms of work with engineers and partners and sponsors and paddock club appearances, and you've done the driver parade. And then I just wanted to sort of lie back, close my eyes. Sometimes I would nap because, you know, you'd already had quite a busy morning. And then make sure you were ready in the garage, you know, 15 minutes or so before the pit lane opened so you could get in the car and then go into the whole procedure. So there's quite a long time from when you leave the pit lane to actually the race starting, it's almost an hour. So, you know, you don't want to use up your energy too early. Did you used to get nervous, Eddie?
Truthfully, yes. I think it's a more daunting, I could be wrong here, David, but I think it's more daunting when you watch the start of a race. And if you're involved, you just want both drivers to get through. You want everybody to get through the first corner. Now, in years gone by, it was more frenetic and just absolutely frantic as to how you went into corners and stuff like that. And some drivers, you would notice if they were out of position, they were going to try harder, and somebody on soft tires and somebody on the mediums or the hards. So you knew there was going to be a discrepancy there. So all of these things flood through your mind. When you're a racing driver, you know what you've got, and you're sitting on the grid and only things that you can see is in front of you. Whereas we've got two cars to look at. And as you rightly say, the morning has been absolutely busy as hell, mainly sponsors. Then you'd have a breakfast, and then you'd go to the paddock club and you'd make a speech, because we try and keep that away from the driver. And so there was a lot of those things. In many respects, I liked the morning warm-up, and because it took away the people from the point of view. We had to clear the pit road. We had to clear the pit lane. And drivers got, what was it, 10, 15 minutes times to do the morning warm-up. And people often used an engine change the night before, so you'd get some miles on you. And then you want to see that everything was working well, whether all the unions have been done up correctly or possibly. So that doesn't happen now because it's the same engine. So there was a lot of other things happening. And I think that I was nervous, there's no doubt. But as soon as we got through the first corner, then it was, pit wall. How can we screw everyone else up except us? How can we come up with a strategy that is so devious that we can actually pull a possible flanker here and do well? And we used to take the most unbelievable risks. But then saying that, we used to fail a lot. But some of those risks, when I think back at the races we won, they were done by some really clever things. And I know we had a couple of weeks ago, we had Gary Anderson on. That man just could see things so differently. And I loved talking to him because we were at opposites. He was a giant. I was a small ass. And, there was every reason why we shouldn't or wouldn't get on. The guy was a genius. And he used to come up with these ideas. He said, EJ, what if we did that? And can we see that? And pit then and take more fuel on and wait till we go on. Even if we're going to go back in the grid, then we'll then be able to make a pit stop and finish the race without stopping. And I'm talking about the French Grand Prix in particular. I think a guy in the field, David, who was our truck driver, and Gary Anderson won that race for us. Not just brilliantly driven by Frentzen, of course, but at the same time, sometimes I'm devoid of that. I see races happening now in Formula One, and I'm thinking, who is making the decisions on the pit lane? Who is the technical people making those calls? Because I just feel that some of the people, we've talked about it with Adrian Newey, we've talked about it with Gary, and we've talked about it with other people, Rob Smedley, for example. I think that I would like to be able to see some of the things that the race designers, race engineers, and the strategists, I'd like that more explained to us, because that's a fabulous area to get involved in.
Now, we've got to get into something, EJ, which is a little bit controversial, because the listeners of this very podcast have been sending in some different points of view when it comes to your Jack Sparrow growl at the beginning of the show and when you sign off. So, for instance, James Rice has said he loves the show, but EJ's growling noise irritates him. We've got Alex Roberts, who must have been one of the shows where he's actually asking, could you get Eddie to do his growl in the first 30 seconds of the podcast so I can skip it easier on my podcast app? We've got another one here, Dobbs900, saying, love the show. Please keep it going. The EJ roar is one of my favourite bits. It cracks me up every time. So as you can see, unsurprisingly, EJ, there's a bit of a split opinion on this.
Not really. It's 2-1 against.
Well,
I want to know which of our editors have put this together. I'm going to query, because it's your company, Whisper, are wrong. It's not fair. There's 2 against and 1 for. Why isn't there 2 for?
Well, listen, I'm sure there was other examples that maybe we should have had 2-2. But the point being, yes, it's a split opinion.
Look, I will say this, that sometimes we often say, no such thing as bad publicity. But in this case, look, it started like that. I'm very happy to forget the growl, because I'm sure at some stage it'll hurt my larynxes. But if you know what those are.
I've got no idea. How many have you got of those? Yeah. Well, anyway, why don't the listeners email us at ffs@whisper.tv. Let us know, should we save the R or should it walk the plank? Maybe have your own noise Eddie should adopt instead. Actually, I'd quite like that. People can send in noises. And we'll pick one or two of them and we'll play it out on future podcasts.
That's not fair. David, that's not fair. I need to lobby it. I need, like every good election, you're asking for a vote. You can be the negative one. You can say, look, we should be past that. Now on 58 or 60.
No, I'm on the fence. You know I love to sit on the fence. I really don't
You've
mind
You've never been anywhere else but on the fence.
There we go.
When have you ever got off the fence?
Right. Let's move it towards the end of the show here. And we've got one of our listeners here asking us if we could recommend, if we had to choose a book, a film, music, food or drink to recommend it to the listeners. Well, I'm going to go with a book, and I'm going to say a book that definitely was influential on me, and it was given to me by Ron Dennis, actually, back when I joined McLaren in 96. And it was a book by Edward de Bono called Six Thinking Hats. And it really was an insight as much to Ron as it was as an education for myself. Where he was a very strategic thinker and wanted to understand how he could unleash more of his brain power. And it's a really good book, I think, for just really stopping to think, you know, how our monkey minds can sometimes get in the way of our, you know, whatever our thought process is at that particular time. So I'd give a book. EJ, I suspect you're probably either going to do music or food and drink somewhere, but any recommendations to our listeners?
I went to see Oppenheimer, and the performance of this guy who I met maybe 10, 12 years ago, or more, 20 years ago, when he and Liam Cunningham are friends of both of us, they won the Palme d'Or in Cannes. And he came and had supper with us in the restaurant across the road from the red carpet. And I'm saying, here's a guy who, you know, so quiet and timid and correct and so articulate and so confident in certain ways, but confident in his own belief, but at the same time wasn't shouting or roaring as you often get at these Cannes festivals. And Cillian Murphy is somebody that I would desperately like to get on our podcast because I think he's a genius. And so anyone who hasn't seen Oppenheimer, he since has won, I think he's the first Irish person in recent years to win the Oscar. It's an amazing piece, but it's just the action. I've sent something. There is a little poem that came out during the week, which I will send to you, David. It's about his voice talking about the words, when you get old. And he talks just like that. And there's the sound of a shore, and it's amazing. So please, guys, have a look at Google. Google When You Get Old by Cillian Murphy. It's absolutely stunning. And a little part of that other story. Have I got 2 seconds, David? I'd like to tell you more about Oppenheimer.
EJ, you know, as long as you want.
So way back in 78, 79, when I was the bones of my ass. And I kind of don't know why, but there was this guy in Marlborough who was the head of Marlborough Worldwide, or of Europe, called George Mackin. And he had a daughter who was a ballerina, but she damaged her foot, so she started, a school for gymnastics and various things in Oxford. And I used to go to her class, and we became good friends because of her dad and various other things. And it was only afterwards, because we had a home in Sotto Grande, and they did too. And Debbie Mackin had a daughter, and that daughter is the girl in Oppenheimer. And, of course, anyone who has seen it, Florence Pugh, who was one of the darlings of the British cinema now, Florence Pugh is the granddaughter of the man who gave me the first money from Marlborough. How unbelievable scary is that? How things can evolve and change around. And I'm so proud of what she does because she was part of that movie, which was very strong.
Yeah, it was. It was still a long watch. I totally agree. The acting was incredible. But
did you fall asleep?
Well, if they could have acted it all in 2 hours, that would have been more comfortable for my attention span.
So why don't we tell that to Killian when we get him on the show?
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, I'm sure he would have been quite happy to have had a shorter script, because I don't think it was the length of the script that made it a success. It was the quality of everything that was put together. Right, EJ, I think that with that recommendation, it's probably time for us to wrap it up and to, of course, thank our listeners and to invite them to follow us, rate us, leave a review wherever you listen to the podcast, and make sure you tell any F1 fans you know all about FFS. So that's all from me. Goodbye, listeners, and thank you. EJ? No.
Am I allowed? One last go, is it?
The time delay between me signing off and you signing off, I thought you'd taken it to heart.
You're making me nervous now. You're saying, Jesus, am I upsetting people? Am I pushing people away from this podcast because I growl?
I never said that. Listen, you're taking it completely out of context. Listen to the show and you'll hear what I said. Anyway, EJ, until we're in the studio together, safe travels and I'll see you soon.
Next time, David, fantastic. You can do better than that.
I think so. I'm not really a growler.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.